Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so we are going to continue with Mukund Tatai from the National Center for Biological Sciences in Bangalore, India. So Mukund is coming from afar, like Stephanie, also from afar, so we thank them. And Mukund is a theoretical physicist interested in the origin of cellular functions from an evolutionary perspective.
Thank you. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you for inviting me to this really wonderful symposium in this amazing institution. So I'm going to be talking about our interests in eukaryote evolution. And I'm going to explain all the words that I'm using here very quickly just to start off. So this concept of affordance is something that I sort of ran into, you know, reading outside of my field. So Gibson, who was interested in neuroscience, coined this word, and I'll just read it. The verb to afford is found in the dictionary, but the noun affordance is not. I have made it up. Affordances of the environment are what it offers the animal, what it provides or furnishes for good or ill. So these are sort of functions that the environment can provide to the animal that will influence its eventual fate. Now, that notion of affordance has been adopted or co-opted by the people who make, you know, products for humans to use, and it's bled into the world of user interface design and so on. And so it's become a little richer and slightly different than Gibson's original formulation. So what is an affordance? An affordance is, where's the pointer? Aspects of an object that indicate and provide opportunities for function, right? So for example, if you have a door with a panel on it, it's clear that, you know, you should push it, even though you don't know much about the mechanisms of how a door works. If it has a handle like this, it's sort of clear, intuitively obvious you should pull it. And having panels and handles makes a door easier to use. And so there's now a notion of whether there is an affordance, there is an opportunity for function, and whether the affordance is perceptible, right? So if it's clear that this is how it can and should be used, then it's more likely to be used. Whereas there are hidden affordances where maybe there's some opportunity for use, but the object doesn't make it clear that it is usable. So I'm going to be using ideas of affordance to think a little bit about function in biological systems. So just like affordance in Gibson's world is some sort of enabler of an interaction between the organism and the environment, there's the affordance. I'm thinking that this, instead of thinking of organism and environment, think of different subsystems in a cell and how they afford functions for each other. And so affordances then takes on a much larger role when you think about how collective systems can operate. And just to reiterate, an affordance is not itself a function, but it's a platform for any other kind of function to build on. Okay. So what are we interested in? We're interested in eukaryote evolution, which is something that's happened over many billions of years. And we looked at many phases of this over the years of research. The idea being that initially there was some sort of symbiotic interaction between an archaeal cell, which is this blob, and mitochondria, pre-mitochondrial bacterial cells. Eventually the mitochondria get endosymbiosed, and perhaps there's some sort of ER or nuclear membrane that emerges in this very early stage of eukaryogenesis. So you have a proto-eukaryote. But if you fast forward to the last eukaryote, a common ancestor, the common ancestor of all living eukaryotes, it's already a very, very complex cell, not just with the nucleus and mitochondria, but with a bunch of other endomembranes and, of course, many other traits like mitosis and cytoskeleton and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, this entire path has left no intermediate states that are still alive. So we have very little information about how cells went from this state to this state. And that's the phase of eukaryotic evolution that we are currently interested in. And since this is meant to be a public talk, I'm going to take 7 minutes of my budget to introduce the broader field. So it's interesting that the terms prokaryote, eukaryote, and so on, although they had been used slightly earlier, they really only became formalized and entered the textbooks in the 60s and 70s. And interestingly, eukaryotes were the ones that were defined first, in some senses, by looking at the EM ultrastructure, the sort of big complex cells. And prokaryotes were defined as the anti-eukaryotes, so cells with very simple internal structures. No offense to the bacterial people in the audience, Jordi. Fast forward again another 10 years, and Carl Woese's pioneering work on environmental sampling and sequencing of RNA, he finds that these prokaryotes break into two completely different kingdoms, which are now called the bacteria and the archaea, coined by him. And the eukaryotes are a separate branch. And the way he saw it is that the eukaryotes and archaea are somehow slightly more closely related than the bacteria, though that turns out to be not the whole story. Nevertheless, this sort of tripartite organization of all living things today has stood the test of time. So then you have mitochondria, which are bacteria, which somehow entered into eukaryotic cells, like I showed you in that cartoon earlier. This was Lynn Margulis's famous endosymbiont theory, based on ideas from earlier. as well. This is the photo of Lynn Margulis and Carl Sagan on their wedding day. So what do we know now? We know that prokaryotes are older. This is just from looking at fossils. And eukaryotes are younger. So in some sense, eukaryotes, maybe they came from prokaryotes, but how? And if you look at it genetically in the modern sense, you don't have to just trace ribosomal RNA. You can look at the entire genome. And it turns out that for all the genes where you can make a link, there's a lot of eukaryotic genes that trace to close bacterial relatives, and there's a lot of eukaryotic genes that trace to close archaeal relatives. So we are all hybrids of these other two great kingdoms, which is it's a very unusual thing when you think about the tree of life, which is meant to be sort of bifurcating, that this coming together of two great kingdoms occurred at all. There's some very nice reviews on this subject, which are relatively recent, and I encourage you to read them. So what we know now is that there's a subgroup of archaea, which are called the Asgard archaea, which are the host cell. There's a subgroup of bacteria, which are related to alpha proteobacteria, which ended up being the mitochondrion. There's a sort of symbiotic event. And then, of course, this long billion-year branch where we don't have any intermediate states, the last eukaryotic common ancestor. These numbers can be taken with a pinch of salt, but you know the order of things here, I think, is reasonable. One of the big questions in this field is, did the endosymbiosis happen in a simple prokaryote or in an already complex prokaryote? And these are called the mitochondria early or mitochondria late hypotheses. 10 years ago, a new group of archaea were found, which are called the Asgard archaea, and they turn out to be very unusual prokaryotes. In fact, Busbaum has just put out a preprint where he shows that there is at least one group of Asgard archaea which have transient internal membranes, so very, very unlike their close cousins. And so these are the archaea that are the ancestors of present-day eukaryotes. However, since we're interested in membrane traffic, one of the things you learn about eukaryotes is these vesicles that move stuff between different compartments. And that vesicle trafficking machinery turns out to depend on very stereotypical protein scaffolds like COP and clathrin and so on, which the Asgard archaea totally lack. On the other hand, if you look at all the Asgard genomes, there are a bunch of proteins which they do encode, which is, if you just look at an online annotation, you know, database, it's annotated as trafficking machinery. So if they don't have vesicle coats, what is this trafficking machinery doing? And one of the things I think they're doing, and we just published this in a review, is if you look at the entire set of trafficking machines the Asgard archaea have, yes, they don't make sort of standard spherical vesicles, right, the Scheckman, Rothman kind of vesicles. However, but they have enough machinery to make tubular carriers, which are still used in modern-day eukaryotes. So there is a good amount of evidence to indicate that Asgard archaea could maintain a functioning membrane trafficking system. So to cut all that very short, remember this is just the primer. At some point in time, a prokaryotic cell eventually ends up having a luminal organelle, which is the endoplasmic reticulum or the nuclear membrane, whatever you want to call it. And then these carriers that move stuff between, I'll call them vesicles, but they're not your coated vesicles. This is the phase of evolution we're interested in. Okay, so now I need to tell you about membrane traffic. So this is the standard picture of membrane traffic in a eukaryotic cell in any textbook. And the reason they don't tell you what eukaryotic cell they're talking about is that all present-day eukaryotes pretty much have the same membrane trafficking system. It's remarkably conserved. There's the nuclear membrane, which is the same as the endoplasmic reticulum. It's contiguous to it. There's the plasma membrane on this side. And then there's a bunch of secretory and endocytic organelles. There's the Golgi apparatus. There's the endosomes, the lysosomes, and then a bunch of other membrane-bounded compartments. The amazing thing about this is that these compartments are constantly exchanging cargo on these vesicles, but their compositions remain, you know, reasonably static over time. So there's some governing principle about how homeostasis is maintained in this system. And what I like about the system is there's two types of emergence. One is the emergence, when you're thinking about it as a physicist, the emergence of this very non-random organization from basic molecular processes. And the other is the emergence of the system from simpler ancestral states over evolutionary time. Okay, so now I'm going to zoom in on one of those arrows. This is where you have a source compartment and a target compartment, and a vesicle is formed, which then takes some cargo from the source and deposits it at the target. The way the vesicle takes the correct cargo from the source, it's not random. There are these things called coat-adapter complexes, which are not the clathrin type, it could be any other type, which will bind to the source compartment, not only create curvature, but also attract the right cargo through some specific protein interactions. These vesicles will then approach the target compartment, either through diffusion or through transport on cytoskeletal tracks. And once it reaches the correct target, then again, the sort of affinity between a protein on the vesicle and a protein on the target, for example, on the snares, the V snares and the T snares, will show the vesicle that it's reached the right target, and that protein binding indeed creates the force that allows the fusion and the release of this yellow cargo molecule or that purple transmembrane cargo. So this is how vesicles move from one place to another. What's interesting about this is the machinery that makes vesicles move from one compartment to another is the same machinery across all the vesicles that operate inside a eukaryotic cell. It's just that there are different copies of those genes in the genome. So there was this phase of eukaryotic evolution where the number of genes encoding the vesicle trafficking machinery exploded by a factor of 10 or 20. And if you look in a present-day eukaryotic cell, different flavors of the same proteins decorate different membranes. So there's some connection between gene duplication and compartmental enrichment. And we wanted to make that hypothesis, which is a very qualitative hypothesis, a little bit more quantitative. In order to do this, we had to create a model, because you can't really do this experimentally, at least not right now. So in our model, we have to have descriptions of objects at multiple biological levels, genes, modules of interacting proteins, networks of flow. Okay, so genes can duplicate or mutate or get deleted. The proteins they encode can interact and regulate one another through feedbacks, like we've heard in many talks today. These things will create flows between different compartments in a manner which I will detail as the talk proceeds. And so this is really the phenotype. The phenotype is the network of different compartments and how they are connected to each other. So you have the genotype-phenotype map. And finally, you have to have some notion of selection. Why is it that this particular phenotype may be better than that one? And this is where the concept of affordance, which is in my title, will come in. So now, if you'll bear with me, I'm going to give you an introduction to our model. This is the model which, you know, is applicable to this talk. We've made many different kinds of models over the past 10 or 15 years, looking at how homeostasis is maintained in membrane traffic. And I'm happy to talk to you about those other types of models, which are more complex than this one, in the break. Okay, so now, what's the usual way you do this, right? The usual way you do this is say, I have a bunch of molecules. For example, I have a coat recruiter, which is on a membrane. It recruits a particular type of coat to make that vesicle. And that vesicle will load a V-snare, which is a vesicle snare, and maybe a V-snare regulator, like an activator. And when it meets the right T-snare on the target compartment, it will fuse. And I'm going to indicate the interactions between these different classes of proteins by these lines. And I would encode this as a sort of differential equation model. And then I would say that this then yields a particular dynamical system, which has this as a steady state, right? And this turns out to be very difficult because you can't search all possible interactions and initial conditions to see what these complex dynamical systems do. So we inverted this process. What we said was, let's just imagine that we have a hypothetical cell where each big node is a compartment, like the ER or some other intracellular compartment or the plasma membrane, which is a kind of compartment. And there are vesicles that move cargo between these compartments, and each vesicle is associated with a different type of coat, which I've assigned with colors. Now, what's interesting about this description is, although there are thousands of molecules that transit through the vesicle trafficking network of modern eukaryotic cells, what's really important about them is not that there are thousands of them, but how many classes of transport flows do they actually admit? And this just depends on which coats which type of cargo like to go on. I mean, you could think of a bunch of buses, and these types of cargo like to go on the pink, on the red bus, or the blue bus, right, or the green bus. And so if there's three coats, for example, then there's only 2 to the 3, which is 8 types of cargo. There's one type of cargo that doesn't travel anywhere. There's one type of cargo that goes on any bus, and so you'll find it everywhere. But then there are other types of cargo which I've colored in the obvious way. So for example, the yellow type of cargo likes the red bus and the green bus, and therefore will only flow on those edges. Now, it turns out that if you give me this hypothesis for the topology of the network and these rules, I can immediately find the assignment of which cargo ends up in which compartment. It's just a simple back of the envelope kind of thing. Any of you can do it. If you sit down with me after the talk, I'll show you how. So I know if these are the flows between these compartments, then these are the compositions. Now what I have to do is to say, is there a way for protein interactions to explain this network? In other words, why is it that this red coat vesicle emerges from this compartment and this one, but not from that compartment? Why is this that this pink cargo vesicle, magenta cargo vesicle, fuses to this compartment and not to that one? Each one of these things has to have a molecular explanation in terms of interactions between proteins. Even more importantly, it's not just the things you see, it's the things you don't see, which should not be enabled by the interactions. Otherwise, I could make everything interact with everything, and I'd get a big mess. Okay, so in summary, if you give me a hypothetical network, I have a mechanism, very efficient, to find out if it has what I call a molecular solution, some molecules that can make it work. The way you do that is it turns out to be a Boolean expression. This Boolean expression has a bunch of conditions about things that have to happen. These are these blue regions, which we call required conditions. And then a bunch of things that have to not happen, which is this red region called the forbidden zone. And this great triangle is in some sense all the possible genes that could be encoded in the genome. All I have to do is to make sure that every blue region has a gene that satisfies that condition and that the red region does not have a gene. Okay. One of the things that could happen is that a red region could completely encompass the blue region in case you have an unsatisfiable expression, you have an impossible graph. So what we did was we scanned all possible graphs up to a certain size, up to a certain number of nodes and edges, and this quickly explodes because it's combinatorial, and so we scanned billions of possible graphs. But the number of graphs with molecular solutions is rather restricted, and we actually tried many types of snare regulation models. I won't get into it for the purposes of this talk, but the point I want you to see is that the graphs that have molecular solutions are exceedingly rare in this space. So then we started to ask, how is it possible for evolution to discover complex networks when these network solutions are so sparse in the space of all possible graphs? So this is the question that we are trying to ask. Now, since I talked about evolution, I have to introduce some evolutionary process. So the evolutionary processes I'm going to talk about are very simple textbook stuff. Here I have a gene, what I'm calling a gene. It's actually a triplet protein interaction between, for example, a V snare, its activator, and a T snare. That's what these edges mean, if you remember back to my little molecular diagram. This thing can duplicate. It could get deleted, or it could mutate. One of the cargo types of one of the proteins involved in that triplet could become another cargo type, and we allow mutations on this little cube of whether it likes a coat or not, right? So these are very conservative molecular changes that we're allowing in the genome. The question is, do these molecular changes allow an efficient and sort of complete exploration of the evolutionary space? So I just take that little schematic I showed you earlier, where remember, the blue regions are required conditions, the red region is a non-required condition, and to make the system work, I have to have at least a black dot in every blue region and no black dots in the red region. What I could do is talk about the solutions for two different kinds of graphs, right? So for example, let's say for graph one, the required regions are blue circles and the forbidden regions are red circles. For graph two, the required regions and forbidden regions are squares. I superimpose them onto the same genomic landscape, and then I can find that there are solutions to the first graph with a particular change, a mutation or a deletion, will allow the second graph to come into being. So these are evolutionary transitions caused by genomic changes, phenotypic transitions caused by genomic changes. There are some graphs, by the way, where two kinds of graphs are possible with the same molecules. It shouldn't be surprising. These are sort of bistable or multistable conditions, where it's the initial condition that chooses which graph eventually comes into being because of the dynamics. Again, in summary, I now have evolutionary moves, and I have ways to check whether one graph can become another graph by evolutionary moves. I'm going to show you an example of this. Here I have a molecular solution for a particular starting graph. Then I have a duplication of this particular triplet. Then I have a change of the color of the cargo of these triplets, which eventually gets you to some state. By the time you get to this state, you get this graph. Then I actually delete one of the proteins and I get to this graph. So these are examples of how simple molecular changes can lead to rather drastic rewiring of the trafficking system. The genotype-phenotype map is far from trivial or easily interpretable. Okay. So this now brings us to this central concept of affordance. I have a way to tell if you give me one graph which represents one vesicle trafficking network, another graph which represents another vesicle trafficking network, whether simple molecular changes can get me from one graph to another. But why should the second graph be selected over the first one? You have to have some notion of function. And this is where we stumbled for a long time, because is the function of these internal compartments phagocytosis? Is it secretion? Is it something else, right? Is it acidification? We don't know. So after a while we decided, and that's when we came across this affordance idea, what we really want is to create compartments that are usable for a variety of functions without committing to which function they are being used for. To make a compartment usable, just follow me along in this bottom right part. Maybe this compartment, which is that internal compartment, for its function requires little Pac-Man molecule to be localized there. And that's, I don't know what it is, but for some function, right? Now, as long as that Pac-Man molecule has a particular marker on that compartment it interacts with, for example, initially it's interacting with the green marker, which is not found anywhere else, the system is fine. And you know, the yellow marker is also not found anywhere else, so it could change from green to yellow. And this is all neutral with respect to function. But what if there's a change in the underlying vesicle trafficking network? Then suddenly you have the rug pulled out under you because this system becomes that system and the green marker is gone. But luckily, you have the yellow marker, which is still there, so this thing is still hanging on. And again, you have another transition due to underlying mutational changes. But now you have a red marker, which this thing is clinging to. So you get the idea that there are neutral changes functionally whereby this function is still maintained even though protein interactions change. And as long as there is a marker uniquely marking that compartment, everything will be fine. Once you lose such a marker, things will go south. So these are the kinds of things which we call affordances. It's a marker that makes that compartment easy to identify and therefore easy to use without too much machinery or computation. I can do the same thing for vesicle edges as well as compartment nodes, by the way. And so those are what we call affordance labels, markers that uniquely mark nodes and edges. And I can summarize, therefore, the functional capacity of the compartment without drawing of the network, without drawing the entire network. I can just summarize its functional capacity by saying, here are the compartments that have good labels, unique labels, and here are the edges that have unique labels. Going back to the bus stop analogy, it means that your bus stops are clearly labeled and that the buses are clearly labeled, and therefore a passenger, whether you're a lawyer or a doctor or whatever it is, you're able to use these buses to go from A to B, and the economy of the city will grow around those functionalities. So this is going to be important. Instead of taking this entire mess of nodes and edges and which vesicles flow between, and notice, by the way, they also contain a lot of self-edges, it's really very complicated. I coarse-grain all that into a very simple thing which we call the affordance motif, which captures the functional potential of that system, that is to say, nodes and edges that are easily labeled and therefore easily used by proteins that the cell is doing who knows what with. I then also have to say something about selection. And the way we think about selection is we call it an affordance ratchet. I allow changes to happen as long as all the earlier functions are preserved. That's all. Maybe new functions come along for the ride. I don't select for them. I allow a change to happen as long as all earlier functions are preserved, at least with high probability. So this is, again, a reasonably conservative evolutionary pressure. It just means that you don't want to die given that you've become acclimatized to a certain lifestyle. So this ratchet means that, for example, an initial state from here, of course, these two are linked by some sort of mutational path, right? But which direction are you going to move? Well, it turns out that the second state has more functional capacity than the first one. So as soon as it comes into being, those functional capacities may not be used, but very, very quickly, we imagine that they will come to be used in some way that is beneficial to the cell. And therefore, it becomes very quickly irreversible to go from this state to that state. Not because I'm selecting for new function, but because it came up by accident. Okay, but what I am selecting for is preservation of the old function. So these affordance motifs then become a catch-all kind of descriptor. Within that affordance motif, there may be many, many types of networks that satisfy the same functional capacity. And I don't really care which one of them I'm using as long as the function is preserved. So there's a lot of underlying, on and off of vesicles and interactions and so on. But phenotypically, the cell, at least functionally, doesn't seem to be impaired. So all this then can be put together to yield a very high-level evolutionary description of the landscape. Here I have explicit networks of flows between compartments and so on. Each of those graphs becomes a node in some big evolutionary landscape. Each dot is actually a whole vesicle trafficking network. And these red edges represent networks and become one to the other due to underlying mutational changes. And I can now group these networks into affordance classes. So these are all the networks that have this affordance motif. These are all the networks that have this affordance motif. Oh, I forgot to mention, by the way, there's a color code where the black is the ER, the sort of blue color is the PM, and the sort of lavender color is another internal compartment. And we stalled out at about 3 or 4 compartments because you just cannot sample bigger than 3 or 4. Okay, so these are different affordance motifs because they involve different compartments and different flows between the compartments. Here are other affordance motifs which look slightly more complex, and here are the allowed transitions. Here's a case where you cannot transition from any of these to any of these because you lose some functionality that was already there. But in all the other cases, you can. Okay, and this is just one example of a much larger evolutionary landscape. And now that I have a landscape, remember, it's completely explicit. I have an entire model of which solutions work for which graph, and therefore I have the entire list of graphs that have solutions, and I have the entire list of mutational moves that will take me from one graph to the other. So I represent this as a sort of big Markov matrix saying from which graph I can get to which other graph by making some sort of evolutionary moves. So then I can either simulate or comprehensively enumerate all trajectories. Here's an example of one such trajectory. I start off with a very simple graph which represents that proto-eukaryotic state. That is, it has a proto-ER, which remember is the first internal membrane with a lumen, and it has the plasma membrane. And it has some vesicles that move stuff from the ER to the PM, because if transmembrane proteins and lipids are synthesized at the ER, there must be some way for them to reach the PM in this proto-eukaryotic state. So this is a very simple assumption for an initial cell. It basically has no functional capabilities because the PM contains the same molecules as the ER. It's very hard to localize things separately to the two membranes. However, I can now make evolutionary moves, And I'm not showing all the colors because this is too much information, but I make a bunch of steps. These are all explicit. I go from this type to this type to this type to this type. And then I end up at some type from which there are no further moves possible because there's nothing else that preserves the existing function. So I stop there. I can just show the same graphs according to their functional affordances, right? So I start with a graph where it's just the ER which is labeled, but there's nothing else going for it. I then have a graph where the PM becomes labeled. This is just one example of many graphs, many trajectories. And I have a flow from the PM to the ER which exists, and then I get changes, and then I get one more mutation which adds another affordance link, then I get a change, and I get another mutation, and finally you get to this final state, which is, you know, functionally much more complex than the original. You can do this over all the trajectories in our network, and it's hard to show all the data, but we're making graphical attempts at doing that. Here's one such attempt, starting with a simple proto-eukaryotic system, ending up at this type of network on this side. How many different trajectories are there and which topologies do they go through? I've labeled all the topologies by different numbers. Okay, and what you see is that the trajectories are very heterogeneous. There are many, many different ways to get to the same endpoint, and also highly contingent. If you accidentally end up at number 4, you're never going to end up at endpoint 13. So very early decisions constrain where you end up later. And this just drops out of the way that these things are encoded within the network. Okay. So now I want to summarize every possible trajectory that I have in the system. So I'm doing that. This is my representation of the full landscape of tens of thousands of different possible networks and how they connect to each other through mutations that do obey this affordance ratchet. Okay, and so here are all the affordance classes. Each one of these classes could have 10, 20, 100,000 different graphs. There are different numbers in each one of those. And what I show with the edge thickness is if I do a Markov simulation of transition starting from this proto-eukaryotic state, then how often do I see that particular edge in a transition? It's just one way to represent connectivity. And you can see that there's many ways to get up. There are endpoints where you actually get stuck. The ones that are labeled with numbers here actually are endpoints where if you end up over there, you can get stuck in some of those systems. So the sort of intermediate endpoints that don't get you any further. But then a large number of trajectories do end up at one of three, you know, rather complex endpoints, regardless of how they move through. So the system is very, very canalized. And yes, it's because there's an affordance ratchet, but the non-trivial statement over here is that it's also extremely connected. It is possible to go from the simple state to the complex state through moves that don't destroy any earlier function. This was unexpected, given the sparsity of these solutions in the big space. Moreover, there is a stereotypical order in which new functionalities are added to the system. Of course, you start with the ER, then a labeled PM, then a labeled internal compartment, and then particular vesicles that connect one compartment to the other, and so on. So there is an order in which these things are gained. Statistically, it's not 100% like this, but there is a statistical order and a sort of reproducibility to playing the tape of evolution in this little game. What are these endpoints? So it turns out it's actually very nice. So here's an endpoint which has an ER, an internal compartment, and a plasma membrane. All three have affordance labels. A lot of edges have affordance labels. And actually, the molecular rules that make this thing work is rather simple. If you sat and thought about it, you may have just written this down to begin with. But remember, evolution discovers this, starting from a very different solution. And why is it interesting? It's because this little network has vesicle flows that resemble phagocytosis from the PM to the internal compartment, secretion from the internal compartment, i.e. the Golgi, to the PM, recycling from the internal compartment to the PM, and then even direct secretion from the ER to the plasma membrane. This is the kind of stuff which modern eukaryotic cells rely on for a lot of their basic functioning. Where do these so one of the things we looked into was when you go from a two-compartment proto-eukaryote to a three-compartment one, where does the new compartment come from? What function does it inherit? And it turns out there's some nice statistics about whether it inherits functions from the proto-ER, from the internal compartment, or gains a de novo function, which is very, very analogous to the ideas of protein subfunctionalization and protein neofunctionalization, where an initial function that two functions that are localized to, say, one compartment then splits between two compartments, or a new function is gained de novo. Okay, now here's something I really liked. Before I got into this, I didn't know how many steps of mutations it would take from the starting proto-eukaryotic state to the final state. I had no guesses. And it turns out that the number of phenotypic jumps, that is the number of jumps that change the structure of the network, is very, very small across all our trajectories. It's off order 10, right? So it just takes 10 phenotypic steps to go from one proto-eukaryotic state to the final reasonably complex eukaryote-like state. But here's the key. Each one of those steps, you end up in one state, But to get to the next state, there's a huge neutral walk that you have to do to put yourself in a position to be primed to make the next change. You're not like ready to go for the next one as you landed. And so these neutral walks are the things that take a long time. And you can see that there's a near uniform distribution of this neutral walk over several orders of magnitude, which means statistically you'll be dominated by the slowest neutral walk. So this is why we're calling it punctuated evolution. It's not punctuated equilibrium, but it certainly is the dynamics where it takes, you make a jump and then you have to wait inordinate amounts of time, and then you make another jump and you have to wait a long time. And if you take very conservative numbers for generation times and mutation rates, you can do maybe 10 to the 4 mutations per gene from the proto-eukaryotic state over a billion years. And luckily, that's enough time for us to see most of the transitions that our graphs require. So to close, what do we see? Here's a picture of evolution in action, where I start off with a network which I'm so this red, blue, and green color is not related to the codes. I apologize for the colors. Blue is one type of network. Red is a different type of network. Green is a different type of network. The yellow trajectory is the evolutionary trajectory. The parts that are in the same color are neutral walks, and then you can have transitions from one network to another. In some cases, the same solution is okay for both. It's bistable, and you could make that transition using regulation. In other cases, the two points are kissing, and so it takes one mutational step to get from one to the other. Of course, there are impossible networks on the outside. Why do these networks have such large neutral spaces? It turns out it's precisely because of the compartmentalization of the vesicle trafficking system. Proteins can gain interaction surfaces without influencing the phenotype because they never run into each other at the same place at the same time. And then some other mutation somewhere else throws them into the same compartment, and then some change ensues. So it's really the vesicle trafficking network and its structure that creates these large neutral landscapes. Okay, so I will close. The work that I just described is out on a preprint, which please go ahead and read. And the earlier stuff I talked about, which is this tubular machinery in Asgard Archaea, is out in annual reviews. Please do come visit NCBS. Actually, you've missed mango season, but it'll come around again next year. And all this is the work of a PhD student, Sahana, and she's currently in Cologne. And that's it. I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.